Of flexible packaging products and by the Super Value Foundation on behalf of Super Value Incorporated and Cub Foods.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten, and today we're broadcasting live from the Republican Party State Convention underway at the Rochester Civic Center in downtown Rochester. The convention officially got underway shortly before 10 this morning, and since then, delegates have been working on routine party business. Big item on the convention agenda comes up tomorrow, when delegates will endorse a candidate for the U.S. Senate, and the contrast between this convention and the DFL state convention last weekend really couldn't be more stark. The signs here at the convention hall tell the story. Last week, the Civic Center was lined with signs extolling the virtues of eight U.S. Senate candidates. This week, Civic Center is blanketed in a sea of red, Rod Graham's for Senate signs. Senator Grams is running for re-election this fall, and delegates are expected to unanimously endorse him tomorrow. Joining us now with that story is Minnesota Public Radio's Mark Sedeklik. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Gary. Bit of a primer on Rod Graham's. He left television news in the early 1990s and got into politics. He defeated DFL Congressman Jerry Sikorski in 1992. 2 years later, he took the Senate seat Republican Dave Durenberger left, defeating DFLer Ann Winia. Republicans say they like Rod Graham's because he does what he says he'll do, and cutting taxes remains his main goal.
I think tax cuts are very important. And you also got to say, in the time of surpluses, I remember years ago they said, well, we can't really afford a tax cut because we have deficits. Well, the deficits have been handled. We now have a budget that's balanced and surpluses on the horizon. So if we can't reduce taxes now, when can we? When we reduce taxes, the economy grows. And in fact, when John F. Kennedy cut taxes in 1961, revenues grew to the federal government by about 20% over 8 years. Every year. When Ronald Reagan's tax cut was approved, revenues grew at about 25% during the 80s. So it's also a good investment to make sure the economy continues to grow.
Graham's is credited for helping to push through Congress the $500 per child tax credit. He's now set on eliminating the so-called marriage penalty and the estate tax, which he calls the death tax. Ultimately, Graham's wants to scrap the entire IRS and replace the complicated tax code with something as simple as a national sales tax. Another thing that Rod Graham's has been talking a lot about is the future of Social Security. He's been pushing hard for changes to Social Security, which would create private individual retirement accounts in which people could invest most of their Social Security withholdings. It's a very controversial proposal, which Graham's DFLer challengers sharply criticize, and it's clearly a plan that Graham's will be promoting and also defending this summer and this fall.
Look, over the last 60 years of Social Security, it's done what we've asked the system to do, and that is provide retirement benefits for millions of Americans. But if you look ahead 30 years, there's a crisis there waiting to happen. We've got the time to look at it. Most politicians, when you say those two words, Social Security, they kind of run for cover, or they want to put a Band-Aid over it and say, well, let's just raise taxes a little bit. But we really need to look at how we're going to make sure that we're going to have a safe, solid, dependable, and good retirement system for this country. We're going to have a retirement system. The question is, what kind?
Some of the other issues in this Senate campaign, national defense. Rod Graham's favors moving ahead with a missile defense system, sort of an advanced version of the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, proposed by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Most of his DFL challengers say further development of such a system would lead to another nuclear arms race. Gun control, it's another big issue. DFLers say it's time for some new laws. Graham says there are enough gun laws in place, and he is opposed to mandatory trigger locks.
There's something like 20,000 laws on the books across the country dealing with guns, the ownership, the type of guns, the sale of guns. So for many of those who want to just say, well, let's add another law onto the books, I don't know how that's going to stop it. Like the two young men in Columbine High School in Colorado broke 19 different laws. I think we need to get very tough on people who commit crimes using guns.
As for his re-election effort, Graham says even though he is the incumbent, it will be a tough race. If he is re-elected, Graham says he will not seek a third term. He says he strongly believes in a citizen, not professional politician-run government.
Our forefathers, when they first went to Congress or state legislators, they went there, and it was part-time, and they lived under those laws. So I think, in another opinion I have, I think if you're there too long, you kind of begin to believe government is the answer, and only government has the, you know, the right way of handling this. And well, maybe people aren't as smart as we thought they are, and maybe we better pass another program to make sure government takes care of them or whatever. So I don't want to, you know, I thought two terms gives me the opportunity to push the issues that I felt so strongly about when I ran. I think I need the time to continue working on them in the second term. But after that, I want to come back and retire into the private sector.
Now, Grams might have a bit of a challenge kind of attracting attention, Gary. You note last weekend there were all these candidates vying for the DFL endorsement. Mm-hmm. They've been getting a lot of coverage. Grams has sort of been overshadowed in recent weeks by all of the DFL coverage. Given the primary race, he'll probably have to work for attention this summer as well. He says he's a bit concerned about the media coverage he's getting, yet at the same time he's glad that he doesn't face a primary challenge, which certainly would generate more attention for him. So that's Rod Grams.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate the profile. And, of course, we'll have live coverage of the endorsement process tomorrow morning starting at 9 here on Minnesota Public Radio. This hour on Midday, we've been joined by Minnesota Public Radio's political analyst, Tom Horner, who is a Republican, and Sarah Stace, who's a DFLer. And we also invite you to join our conversation. We're talking politics this hour on Midday, especially Republican Party politics. And if you have a question or comment for our analysts, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Tom, Sarah, thanks for coming by today.
Thank you, Gary.
Now, Tom, you look a lot more relaxed than last week. Sarah, you look very stunning in your fake mustache.
My Republican pearls and gold dripping off me.
Well, you'll notice, Gary, that the biggest contrast to last week's DFL convention is that people here are polite, they're orderly, most of them are in business attire, there's nary a Birkenstock to be found in the convention hall. And we don't allow tables for the delegates. We seat them in chairs so they can't spread out with pizza and chips and other messy kinds of accoutrements.
Well, you know, the democratic process is an organic process, and some would say that imposing hierarchical structures on an organic process is not a good idea, that it stifles debate and that generally kind of dampens enthusiasm for politics.
Well, there was a fairly lively, it was a fairly obscure debate this morning, but a pretty lively one over that very issue. Some of the delegates accusing party officials of squelching legitimate dissent. And what was that all about?
Well, I think it's what happens that at every convention where there's no compelling issue, you go out and find issues. And I think, you know, what happens in a Republican convention, particularly in a year where you have an incumbent senator who you're going to endorse, and that's the only ballot question for candidates, that people start looking for issues to fight over. One of the issues that is occurring in the Republican convention that actually has some significance, two issues, in fact. One is a continuation of an issue that surfaced about 4 years ago in the Republican Party over judicial endorsement. And I know Representative Plenty talked about this. Should political parties endorse candidates for the judiciary? And we're seeing right now, you know, some of the unfortunate fallout from that in some of the literature being passed around that is really a vicious and unwarranted attack on some of the incumbent justices, including Supreme Court Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz, a good Republican, I might add. The other issue has to do with the platform and a feeling among some of the delegates that perhaps the 2000 platform, this year's platform, has become a little too, as some delegates describe it, Clintonesque, a little too focused on more spending and a little less focused on some of the social issues. And so there's a move afoot to replace the 2000 platform in toto with the 1998 platform, which is a very strong document of conservative values.
Now, is this
that's certainly an example of backward thinking, to replace a 2000 platform with a 1998 platform.
If you have something good and it works for you, you stick with it, Sarah.
Is this the kind of thing, though, that is only of interest to the people here, or is this the kind of issue that will bubble around and could conceivably cause Republican candidates some problems this fall?
Well, you know, I think this question of politicizing the judicial selection process is a pretty significant issue that may have some legs more popularly. This is something that is obviously very appealing to people on one extreme or another of the kind of the political spectrum, but it's a dangerous, very, very dangerous movement to take up, because although we might say, if we are right-wing Republicans, think that it's a good idea today because we think that we are in the electoral majority, clearly the political pendulum does swing back and forth, as Representative Pawlenty was pointing out, and very easily those people who would be in favor of politicizing this process today would be strongly against it tomorrow should more left-leaning politicians take over.
Well, and I think on the platform issue, whether it makes a difference, whether people outside of this convention hall pay attention to it, you know, platforms have become something like endorsements, much to the consternation of party activists in both parties, where I think a lot of people feel that a platform is something that you do as part of a convention, and after that, it doesn't carry much weight. And I think it is part of the problem that both parties face of how they make themselves meaningful, how they reinvigorate their stature in the political process. And they won't do it. And again, it's both parties, the Republicans being too far to the right, the Democratic platform being too far to the left. They won't do it if they keep coming up with candidates and positions that don't connect with mainstream Minnesotans.
Our guests this hour, political analyst Tom Horner, the Republican, Sarah Stace, the Democrat, and we're broadcasting live today from the Republican Party State Convention in Rochester. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 1-800-242-2828. That's good all across the region, 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin City metro area, dial our local number, 651-227-6000. Well, Lord knows there's been lots of hype about the Senate race, the Senate contest that we're going to have this fall, and some people say that it holds the key to which party will control the U.S. Senate. Is that true?
It's one of the keys, certainly. It's a very, very important race. Another important key is the presidential race, however, and very important who is leading in November as to who ultimately will influence the Senate race and also the House race as well, and Senate race in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think Minnesota is going to be the focal not just for the United States, a focal point not just for the United States Senate, but perhaps for the U.S. House of Representatives. You know, I think most people, and you never want to count your chickens before they hatch, but I think most people would say that the United States Senate probably is going to stay Republican. There's enough of a cushion there, enough safe seats, enough vulnerable Democratic seats, enough open seats in play where it's probably going to stay Republican. The real contest comes in the House, where the balance is much closer, and each race becomes very significant. And in Minnesota, we potentially have two, maybe three, very, very closely contested races. For Republicans, you know, we look at the 4th District, where Representative Bento is retiring, an open seat. We have a strong candidate in Linda Runbeck, a state legislator, who I think, given how that district has changed over the years in terms of its population, could be a terrific candidate. And then in the 6th District against incumbent Bill Luther, we have John Klein, who surprised everybody 2 years ago when he made that a competitive race, and this year now has attracted the attention of a lot of folks around the country, is going to have probably enough money to be a competitive contender for that seat, and could very well be one of the big upsets nationally in the House of Representatives.
Sarah, you see those as nip and tuckers?
Well, the 4th District is an interesting district. It is much more suburban now than it used to be, and so consequently, because the suburban vote tends to be more conservative than the city vote, it does tend to be a more favorable district to Republicans than it used to be. However, I still think that the majority lies very strongly in Democratic hands. Linda Runbeck, while there are some attractive features about her, to be sure, she is also a candidate who has staked out some very far-right positions her position in the Minnesota legislature. And those positions you can count on being very big issues. in this election. She's running against Betty McCollum, another legislator who is a much more moderate person. She's not somebody who can be characterized as far left, and so she tends to, and she is from the suburbs, and so she tends to have a much more natural appeal in the 4th District suburban area. The other issue about Linda Runbeck, of course, is that she doesn't actually live in the 4th District, and while that did not prevent her from becoming the endorsed candidate for the Republican Party, it'll certainly be an issue district-wide in the 4th District.
Oh, we'll just start calling her Hillary Runbeck.
Tom Horner, Sarah Stace, our guests this hour, Minnesota Public Radio's political analysts. And again, if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here. We're broadcasting live from the Republican Party State Convention. Delegates are getting close now to going out to lunch. This afternoon, they'll hear from several speakers, including legislative leaders Steve Swigum and Dick Day. St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman, who's the chair of the Bush campaign in Minnesota, will be addressing delegates. You can hear all those speeches live on our website, npr.org. Of course, we'll have a nice summary report on all things considered this afternoon. Then we're back on the air with extended live coverage starting at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And wrapped into that coverage, we're everywhere. We'll have the president's address. He's at Carleton tomorrow, so bouncing all over. Right now, if you have a question for our analysts, again, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to Tom, who joins us from Mankato. Morning, Tom, or good afternoon, I'm sorry.
Yeah, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's close, you know.
Yeah.
What's your question?
Well, my comment is something that was just brought up about the people that put the platforms together for the various political parties. I think it illustrates how far out and removed they are from the general body politic. Because, I've gone to a Democratic caucus where they were debating Social Security benefits for Bosnians. And on the Republican side, the Libertarians have this headlock on the party that really makes any kind of intellectual or rational discussion about government policies to be ridiculous. So I'd like to hear some comments on that, please.
Well, you know, Tom, I think the answer to that is that more people like you who believe that both parties are extreme should get involved in the process and attend their caucuses so that you and others who are like-minded can influence the outcome of the platform debate. It is because so many people do stay home who tend to be more moderate or centrist from both parties that we occasionally will end up with both party platforms not being as representative of the broader majority as we wish that they were. So I would strongly encourage you to continue attending your caucuses, to organize others in your neighborhood and family, your friends, your coworkers, to attend caucuses of both parties so that we can alleviate the situation.
But Sarah, people have been urging Minnesotans to get involved for years and years and years. And actually, attendance has been going down, down, down.
Yes.
Doesn't that say something about the process itself? I mean, that.
Well, why do we jump to the conclusion that it says something about the process itself and not about the people themselves? In fact, voter participation nationally has been going down, down, down in every single election, and that is a very significant problem. Just in terms of our ability to maintain our small d democracy, our way of governing. And so I guess I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that this is a process problem. I would jump to the conclusion that this is a different kind of problem, and it's one that we all ought to be concerned about, not just here in Minnesota, but all the way across the country.
Tom, what do you think?
Well, I think we do have to find better ways to connect parties and candidates to people, whether that's through some of the new communications technology, whether it's through parties and candidates doing more around the state to connect with people. I mean, I still like the caucus system as at least a part of the process. I think it's one of those almost unique Minnesota kinds of things that tremendous opportunity for grassroots involvement. I think the party systems, you know, speak pretty well to grassroots politics. And look at last week. Jerry Janicich, the DFL-endorsed candidate, would not be the candidate for the United States Senate were it not for the open process of Minnesota's political parties. And, you know, as he said, here's a bar owner from Chisholm who's going to be a candidate for the United States Senate. You know, that has some value, frankly. But having said that, you know, absolutely. I think we do have to find ways to get people engaged, to make that connection between the use of their time and the importance of what's going on here and the importance of what goes on in St. Paul and what goes on in your city hall and what goes on in Washington. So it's not just involvement around conventions and candidates and platforms. It's involvement around issues. Pick up the phone and call your legislator. Write a letter. Go attend an Eggs and Issues candidate forum. You got to get involved. You can't just sit on the back bench whining about it.
Truly, I was just going to say, to Tom's point about getting involved with the legislative process, it is extremely easy to contact your legislator and to be heard. In fact, it's pretty easy to organize a small number of calls, which, you know, within the broader context, are taken together very influential and can really make a difference in terms of a legislator's thinking on a particular issue and can influence a vote. The lobbying process is very open. It's a very citizen-friendly process, and so anybody can go down to the Capitol, or if they don't want to go there, can email or can call and can be heard. So I would just strongly echo those comments that Tom made.
State Party Chair Rod Ebensteiner has joined us here at our broadcast table. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon. Nice to be here.
Are you a little frustrated by the difficulty in getting people outside of this hall interested in this process?
Well, that's something that we're always working on very diligently, is to appeal to more people, to broaden the base of the Republican Party, to make sure that it speaks for, you know, 60-65% of the people here in Minnesota. We're never going to be the party that speaks for 90% or 95%, just the same way with the Democrats. But we do have to get our message out. And I agree with both Sarah and Tom, is that it is really important that people get involved. You know, it never ceases to amaze me how easy it is to change public policy if you get involved. If you don't get involved, you can only complain about it. And I'm in the business community. And as you may have know, that there's a lot of business folks here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in Minnesota in general, that are very disgusted, I think, with the business climate here in the state, and they would like to see policies change on this or that. And almost invariably, I will ask them the question, well, have you attended a caucus meeting recently? Have you called your representative? And the answer is no. And I said, well, you can't change public policy if you don't get involved. And if you don't get involved, you merely vacate the field for people with less good intentions. And it's absolutely important. I was recently at a, I think it was a Chamber of Commerce event, and I asked the folks, you know, how many of them have gotten involved in the political process. And there weren't very many. And so I said, well, how many of you people consider yourself in the middle, you know, the centrist? And half of the people in the audience raised their hand. And then I asked them a question, how many of you have attended a caucus? No hands went up. How many of you have been down to the state capitol? How many of you even know who your state legislator is? And it was absolutely mind-boggling, and here they were telling me how frustrated they are with government, and yet no one makes the initiative to get involved. Getting involved is part of democratic ideals for democracy, and if we want a good democracy, we have to be involved.
Now, there was a kind of a lively debate here first thing this morning, right after the convention got underway, and people were accusing party leaders of trying to squelch dissent and unconstitutional behavior. What's that? Big rift in the party?
Well, no, not at all. See, we don't have a contest for the U.S. Senate like the Democrats did. And so, you know, when you get together at a party convention, people like contests, and they like a little spirited discussion and play. And so I don't make much of that. We will have a discussion on the platform. What
do you think the platform, the new version, is too Clinton-esque?
No, what the platform committee was trying to do, and that is trying to make it a little shorter, a little smaller, and it's really a philosophical divide, or a philosophical marketing piece. And so what we wanted to do is just simplify it a bit, so that it can be used as a marketing piece more effectively. And, you know, some folks like the lengthy platform. And you know, my attitude on that is if the people here at the convention want the platform basically in its entirety, in its length, like we had in 1998, that's fine with me. We were just trying to simplify and make it a little more of a marketing piece for us.
Are you worried at all that your Senate candidate, Rod Grams, still can't get over 50% in terms of the approval ratings? In fact, I think he's in kind of mid-40s. Is that troubling at all?
Well, I don't know. It's still pretty early. It really doesn't. He has a lot of support in Minnesota, especially in greater Minnesota. You know, political pundits have consistently underestimated him. When he first ran for Congress against Sikorsky in 1992, he beat a sitting congressman who was quite popular at the time. And that was a surprise. And then in 1994, when he decided to run for the Senate, a lot of people didn't think he could get the Republican nomination. Well, he got the Republican nomination and then went on to win the general election. So Rod will be out there working very hard, getting his message out, connecting with the people. And I don't see any Democrats out there right now that can defeat him at this point. And but we still have, you know, 4 or 5 months to go.
Finally, have you been able to paper over the rift that developed at the end of the legislative session, one of the party's major donors, Michael Wigley, firing off emails and...
Well,
pretty mad that that more substantial tax cuts weren't passed, demanding that Speaker Swigum be removed because he hadn't taken a hard enough line.
Let's first correct the record here. Mike Wigley has not given to the Republican Party. So he, in my book, he's not one of the major contributors to the party. He hasn't contributed any money to date. But Mike Wigley was just exercising his free speech, shall we say, and he was disappointed that the tax cuts were not larger. Myself included, I was disappointed as well, as were a lot of Republicans. If you talk to Steve Swigum and Tim Pawlenty, they were also disappointed that the tax cuts weren't larger. But when you have the DFLers controlling the Senate, who are absolutely opposed to tax cuts, they are more in favor of more spending and more government programs and more regulation. And then you have a governor who's largely absent. He was not involved in the legislative process at all during the... and I've said this on a number of occasions. Roger Moore was more of a governor than Jesse Ventura, and Steve Swigum and Tim Pawlenty were more governors than Jesse Ventura. And so you had kind of a funny situation there. And then at the last minute... I think out of frustration, somebody proposed, and it may have been Roger Moe, proposed this one-third, one-third, one-third business, not thinking that it was a serious proposal, and Jesse jumps on that and says, yeah, that's what I want to do. Well, to me, that's not leadership. You hire a chief executive officer to run your company or you run the state, and we have a chief executive officer who basically is quite absent. He certainly was absent in the last legislative session. So is there a rift within the party? No. And I know some people were disappointed. But at the end of the day, you have to look at the results. Over the last 2 years, Republicans, with the Republicans' control of the House, we pushed through the largest tax cut in Minnesota state history, and in fact, one of the two states who had the largest tax cuts in the last 2 years. So all in all, we're very united.
Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great convention.
Well, thank you very much.
Republican Party State Chair Ron Ebensteiner joining us here at our broadcast table. We're broadcasting live from the Republican Party State Convention underway at the Mayo Civic Center in downtown Rochester. Our guests this hour, political analysts Tom Horner, Sarah Stace. If you've got a question for our analysts, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to more callers in just a couple of minutes. Right now, news headlines. Here's William Wilcoxon. William?
Thanks, Gary. In the news, the White House is vowing that President Clinton will veto a Republican move to end the estate tax. Press Secretary Joe Lockhart says the move is a thinly disguised windfall for the well-to-do. Republican lawmakers say what they call the death tax forces the heirs of farmers and small business owners to sell out in order to pay. The Justice Department is again rejecting an alleged conspiracy in the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination. An 18-month probe found no credible evidence that anyone but James Earl Ray killed the civil rights leader. The department recommended no further investigation. The new investigation rejected allegations from several people that federal agents, police, and others took part in a plot to kill King in 1968. Federal investigators think some hackers are positioning themselves to launch an attack designed to shut down various websites. A network security firm that does work for the Justice Department says hackers have infected 2,000 computers with a malicious program disguised as a movie clip. The file essentially turns the infected computer into a zombie machine that the hackers can control. Several hundred people marching in downtown Minneapolis today were joined by the Reverend Jesse Jackson to push for better wages and benefits for area hotel and restaurant employees. Workers at 9 Minneapolis and Bloomington hotels have voted to authorize a strike. 94% of the voting members of hotel employees and restaurant employees, Union Local 17, endorsed a strike in voting that was tabulated yesterday. And jury selection was delayed again today in Donald Blum's trial on kidnapping and murder charges. His attorney requested that Blum be transferred each day between the Carlton County Jail and the St. Louis County Courthouse in Virginia, Minnesota. Judge Gary Pagliacetti denied the request, but Blum's attorney has asked the State Department of Corrections for another opinion. A chance of thunderstorms in northern Minnesota today with a high in the 70s. Windy and hot elsewhere in the state. There's a wind advisory in effect for southwestern counties. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's sunny and 83 degrees. And that's the latest news from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm William Wilcoxon.
Thanks, William. 23 minutes now before 1 o'clock. Midday coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio, live from the Republican Party State Convention in Rochester. Alexander's on the line from St. Paul with a question for our political analysts, Horner and Stace. Go ahead, Alexander.
Hello. Greetings from St. Paul. You might remember me. I was the delegate at the Democratic State Convention that fell asleep on the table. I was in the Tribune there. But just to show you that I was paying attention, I feel that what Edensteiner said about being involved in government and so forth, I think the reason why people don't get involved in government is because they realize that corporations are in charge of government. The government is no longer in charge, that the corporations have become a de facto government. Given that, I'm wondering, seeing as, let's presume that there are two candidates in the DFL that stand a chance against Rock Brands, Mr. Janicich and Mr. Cerisi. Given that Mr. Cerisi is significantly funded by outside corporate interests and so forth, as is Rod Graham, who received the most contributions from credit card companies of any senator to thwart the bankruptcy process, I'm wondering, do you think that Janicich's electability concerns have certainly come up in the news? Do you think Janicich or Cerisi has a better chance against Rod Graham, seeing as Janicich is kind of, he was a bartender before he was in the state legislature. He's kind of your regular Joe Schmo, kind of what people are looking for, as can be seen by the election of Mr. Ventura, not to make any analogous relationship between the two, of course. Okay. Wondering what your
Alexander. Alexander, this is Tom Horner. But let me just ask you a question. If the National Rifle Association gave $5,000, which is the maximum contribution to Paul Wellstone, would Paul Wellstone be voting for loosening gun laws?
Probably not.
And if the gun lobby, the gun control lobby, gave $5,000 to Rod Grams, would he change his vote?
The gun control lobby? Probably not.
My point is that I think money has dominated too much of the political process, but not in the way that I think people think. And Alexander, I've got to say, not in the way that you pose your question. I don't think it's corporate interest, because in fact, you know, corporate interests are really limited in what they can give to candidates. Now, they can get involved through soft money. That's a problem. These new 527, 527 nonprofit political groups where people don't even have to disclose are a problem. But, you know, I do think, Alexander, that it does go back, particularly at the state level, that, you know, 10 or 12 calls from people who are knowledgeable, thoughtful, and care about an issue to a legislator make a world of difference. I mean, bills move on the basis of 10 or 12 constituent calls. Laws get passed on the basis of 10 or 12 constituent calls. It's people who sit back and say, oh, there's too much money, there's too much big, powerful interest involved, that my little voice doesn't make a difference, that leave the door open to big, powerful interests.
You know, Tom, I completely agree with you in the sense that small numbers of constituents can have a lot of influence on policy debates at the legislature. That has been shown time and time again. And so, Alexander, I would strongly encourage you to, if you're not involved, to get involved at the policy debate level at the state legislature at least. Now, on the other hand, to say that money is not relevant in politics is also not true.
And I didn't say that. Right.
Okay. All right. Both political parties are absolutely awash in money, and the Republican Party in particular is awash in money. And money is very, very influential in determining an outcome in a race. As we look at this whole question of the primary, for example, versus the caucuses, the question of money is extremely relevant because, as Tom was pointing out earlier, how could a bar owner from Chisholm, Minnesota, in the name of Jerry Janusich or anyone else, be able to be an important candidate for the U.S. Senate out of the state of Minnesota, but for the caucus system, which anyone can access for a very small amount of money? Contrast that with the primary system, for example, in which you really do have to have a lot of money because this is a system that is run very much based on paid media and very expensive to run. And so, consequently, very, very... Go ahead.
I was just going to say now that the other part of Alexander's basic question here, in terms of the Senate race this fall, Rod Grams will be the Republican candidate, and he's suggesting that either Senator Janusich or Michael Cerisi will end up as the DFL candidate. There are two others
yeah,
in the
I was
primary,
just going to say, don't forget that there are two others
Mark
in the primary.
Mark Dayton and Rebecca Yanish. Mm-hmm. But... How does that race in the fall stack up? Does Rod Grams run well against all of these Democrats, and does he go into the would he go into the fall election as kind of the favorite to match up well, or is he particularly vulnerable as we keep hearing?
I think any time you have an incumbent United States Senator in good economic times where there are no overriding compelling issues that are engaging the public, he's the favorite, or she's the favorite. Rod Grams clearly, I think, will be the favorite going in against any of the four Democrats. I think each of the four has weaknesses and strengths. You know, to Sarah's point about can money control a primary, maybe, but the other side of a primary is that there are only going to be about 350,000 votes cast in the DFL primary. Could Jerry Janusich win it by organizing the traditionally strong DFL 8th district or unions? Of course. I mean, any one of the four conceivably could get 100,000 votes and win the primary. And each of the four, I think, brings vulnerabilities against Rod Grams, again, particularly in good economic times where you have an incumbent senator.
One thing that happened during the last primary, which was interesting, is that all of the Democratic candidates were quite united in focusing on their Republican challenger, Norm Coleman. And as he himself was admitting earlier on this program, that hurt him because they spent the summer taking shots at him and not as much at one another. They were able to differentiate enough with the Democratic voters that they were also able to go beyond that message and deliver a stronger message to the general election voters, which was that Norm Coleman was not a good candidate for governor. And if this time the Democrats are able to stick to that message overall, I believe that in the end that the Democratic challenger, whoever that may be, as the victorious candidate out of the Democratic primary, will be able to defeat Rod Grams. Remember that Rod Grams was elected with a very slim majority, and has had very low favorability ratings this entire time. He has not been very present in Minnesota, so consequently a lot of people don't know him. They don't have an empathic kind of connection with Rod Grams. He's a very vulnerable candidate. He's been identified by the Democratic National Committee as one of the top Senate candidates to target nationally. And so I think that if the Democrats within the primary can stay unified and focus on what they really want, which is to beat Rod Grams in the fall, that they'll have a good chance of doing that.
But a couple of significant differences, Sarah. First of all, in 1998, you had candidates, particularly the three front runners in Mondale, Freeman, and Humphrey, who had a long history together of working together, long tradition within the party, and you don't have that this year. In fact, you have a candidate in Mike Cerisi who has virtually no history of involvement in the DFL party, who, by all accounts, was extremely offended by what happened at the convention and the attack personalized against him, who has made it clear that he's not going to be the whipping boy going into the primary, and he will do what needs to be done to win. So I don't think it's going to be the same kind of primary where all the focus is on Rod Grams. And secondly, you have in Rod Grams a candidate who has connected with people, and while he doesn't have a broad range of issues, those issues that he has worked on, where he has had success and where both parties credit him with success, are issues that really do connect well at an emotional level with Minnesotans.
This came up in the first hour, but I think it's worth coming back to again. In theory, you could have at the presidential level, the Senate level, presumably at the congressional level as well, state level, I suppose, legislative level, a great debate this fall on some really fundamental issues, not the marginal things that people don't tune into, but some really fundamental issues, Social Security, whole issue of trade and globalization and how that impacts people, health care, national defense, education, all the biggies. Are we going to have that debate this fall, or are we going to be subjected to a barrage of 30-second ads that simply oversimplify and just brand the other guy as a bum?
You know, I think at the Senate level, I don't think that will occur. I think you have in Rod Grams, for example, with Social Security, a candidate who, whether you agree with his position or not, has put out a thoughtful position. He has articulated a lot of details around Social Security reform. And what we heard last week from the DFL candidates was not a response substantively, but a response politically that, you know, Rod Grams is going to destroy the security of older Americans, and Rod Grams is robbing from the younger workers, and no alternatives. And I think when you have an issue like that, where a lot of Democrats still feel that you can demagogue that issue and win more votes on it than you can by speaking substantively on that issue, I don't think we're going to have the debate. I also think, however, that that issue has flipped, and people want to hear ideas and they want to hear substance. On taxes and the other issues, Gary, at the Senate race, I think it's going to be more demagoguery against an incumbent senator, because that's how candidates traditionally run against incumbents, and there's nothing to suggest that this year is going to be any different.
Sarah?
Well, I guess I prefer to take a more optimistic standpoint here. I hope that we're not going to see demagoguery. Obviously, if we're reduced to running this campaign based on 30-second commercials, there's a great danger of that. But as people have been pointing out today, this is a chance really to look at two very different sets of ideas about how to approach government. The Social Security proposals, for example, are very, very different. This is classically a Democratic issue. The Republicans are trying to take it away. They've put something on the table, not just Rod Grams, but nationally, that is an issue which, has some substance to it. I don't think that the Republicans will be able to take the issue away from the Democrats simply because older Americans tend to vote in greater numbers proportionately than younger Americans do, and most tend to be very risk-averse when it comes to money that they're trying to live on today. Nonetheless, it's a good thing to put issues like this on the table so that we can have this debate. So I am looking forward to the fall with a degree of optimism and a certain amount of high spirit about what we could see in the fall, and I'm hoping that will happen.
Let's go back to the phones. Joe's on the line for Prior Lake with a question for our analysts. Joe?
Well, this goes back to a couple of the comments that your guests have made. One of the comments was that they don't think that it is the process, that it is more the people that is disenfranchising the people with the government. That your other guest had said that we should get more people involved, and that it's very easy to get involved, and that, you know, 6 or 10 phone calls can sway what the government representative's opinions might be. And I guess my point is, we vote to try to elect people to do the will of the people. And to ask people in their schedules today, time is the most valuable commodity, to ask them to come and say, you know, get involved, take the time, do more, they're going to have to take that away from either the family or their work or their private time. And I think that's a little bit unrealistic to expect in today's society. And you see this reflected by the dwindling numbers of people who do indeed vote and participate. And I just don't think it's realistic. And if you can't develop a process that addresses that, then I think you're really missing the boat. And I think this is the main reason why people feel so disenfranchised with the current government that we have.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Well, you know, I completely sympathize with people who are overextended in their lives and have way too many things to do. I feel that way myself in my daily life, and I know exactly what that's like. But it really doesn't take very much time to go to a polling place to vote. I never have had to stand in line more than about 5 minutes. In fact, I have always taken my daughter with me because it's something that we can very easily do on the way to school. I think it's a good way to educate her about her civic responsibility, and it takes almost no time at all, and it doesn't happen very often.
You know, I'd say to Joe, look, you're talking about a system that takes one-third of your income, that educates your children, that provides health care for millions of Americans, that provides for our security, and on and on and on. And Joe, get a life. I mean, we are overextended, but if you can't find a couple of minutes to get involved, to make a call, to go vote, to learn about candidates, then I'd say you have no right to complain. We have a representative democracy. We elect people to represent us. And if we're not going to tell people how to represent us, if we're not going to let them know what we think about issues, if we're not going to get engaged, then I think you ought to sit in the back bench and take whatever comes your way. I mean, it isn't easy, and it does take time, and I acknowledge all of that, and I acknowledge that we're overextended. I have 3 kids. I'm involved with them. I own a business. I'm involved with that, and I do a lot of other things in my community. But I also think that it's important to get involved. It's important to make a call, to write a letter, to talk to a candidate, to talk to a legislator, and let them know. And if you're not going to do that, then don't complain.
Howard's on the line from Rochester. Howard, are you just outside the Civic Center here with your cell phone? Or
no, sir. Actually, no, sir. I'm in my house there, and I'm barbecuing outside.
Okay, what's
that
your question,
good.
Please?
Okay. First of all, let me identify myself. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm a conservative, independent, and I always vote who I think's best for the country. But I've been listening quite a bit to the party chairman and also to Rod Grams about how the Republicans are so good at spending at taxes, and I think that is just a bunch of baloney. I've got in front of me 2 articles that have come out of business magazines. One is Business Week magazine, which is usually pretty in favor of the Republicans, and the other is Investors Business Daily. Now, Business Week magazine has an article, and this is the title.
Okay.
The GOP tax cut.
Howard, if you could get to your point there.
We're running
out of time.
GOP tax cut. Now you see it, now you don't. The Investor Business Daily, this is the title, Big Spending Republicans. Republicans took over Congress in 1995 and have helped boost discretionary spending even faster than the Democratic-controlled Congress. What are these Republicans talking about? Spending is $1.77 trillion every fiscal year, and the people who do that spending are the appropriations chairmen, and they are all Republicans.
Okay, how do you plead, Tom Horner, Republican?
Partly guilty, or guilty with an explanation. I mean, I think Howard makes a good point that spending does continue to grow, and it's not just the federal government, but state government as well. And we're spending more today than we were when Jesse Ventura was elected, and we were spending more when Jesse Ventura was elected than we were when Arne Carlson was elected 8 years earlier. But I think the answer lies in a couple of things. First of all, you have a lot of programs that have built-in increases, and a lot of programs are designed to meet need, and as need expands, the spending expands, or the inflation increases, those kinds of things. Secondly, in Washington, in St. Paul, Republicans don't run the show. Republicans share power, and so Steve Sigum and Tim Pawlenty in the House put on the table and passed an $800 million tax cut in the House of Representatives this year, and it went nowhere because the Democrats in the Senate and Jesse Ventura in the governor's mansion weren't going to accept that, and so down the tubes it went. But I'd also say, and Howard is right on this point, that Republicans, I think, have to take the lead in finding ways to meet needs, to address the issues of people more innovatively, more creatively? How do we use our resources better? I mean, there's a great program that I was involved with in St. Paul with the Wilder Foundation that brought together the state government, city government, school districts, private sector to make better use of our education resources and spend more wisely. You know, we need to be looking at those kinds of innovative things.
Well, the other thing that happens when Republicans get elected is they find out that in spite of whatever rhetoric they might have run on, there are some very real needs out there that government appropriately needs to take care of. For example, roads, and roads are extremely expensive, but we need roads. Roads are important so that we can get to work, so that our economy can function, so on and so forth. Education, there are many needs that government fills, and as responsible members of government, Republicans have looked at those needs and have provided funding to make sure that, in fact, our roads don't fall apart, for example. So I think that there's a bit of a gap between some of the rhetoric that Republicans use to get elected, in fact, potentially setting up some false expectations among the minds of the electorate, and then when they get elected, they find out that they do, in fact, have to appropriate money to pay for some of these things that we all need.
President Clinton comes to Minnesota, well, actually tonight, but he'll be speaking at Carleton tomorrow, and then they'll have some fundraisers. Senator Graham suggests that this is not a coincidence, the timing of the visit,
you know,
that it's overshadowing this convention and designed to do so. Is he on track here?
I just wish the Democrats could be that organized.
Oh, you know, I think the president being here has more to do with, you know, Carleton's a good small liberal college, and he likes to do those kinds of commencement speeches. Paul Wellstone and his connection to Carleton. And I think, frankly, that Bill Clinton, on behalf of Al Gore and Democrats nationally, want to build a connection with Jesse Ventura and capture some of his popularity and piggyback on that. And, you know, it's why President Clinton is building frequent flyer miles on all of his trips to Minnesota lately.
Finally, before we wrap up, a quick comment. No doubt about it, Rod Grams will be endorsed tomorrow.
You're not going to ask for a prediction, Gary?
No. No predictions needed today. And I'm sure it'll be unanimous, and we'll hear from Senator Grams tomorrow and everything. Will these delegates be enthusiastically endorsing him, or will they be endorsing him because he's the incumbent and he's their best chance to win? I mean, is he really connected with these people?
Certainly with these delegates, absolutely. I mean, these are Rod Graham's people, and I think they'll be very enthusiastic. And I think as they hear more and more of the rhetoric coming from the DFL side, they'll become even more enthusiastic and engaged.
This is going to be a wonderful celebration for Rod Graham's tomorrow. I can predict that.
And you folks will be joining us for it.
And looking Indeed. Forward to it.
Thanks for coming by today.
Thank you.
Political analysts Tom Horner, who is the Republican, Sarah Stace, the Democrat, joining us here at our broadcast table at the Republican Party State Convention underway at the Mayo Civic Center. The delegates are having lunch right now, and they'll be reconvening this afternoon for more party business, mostly internal party business. They will have some speakers at the podium, though, including legislative leaders Steve Swigum and Dick Day, and St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman, who is the chair of the Bush campaign here in the state of Minnesota. He'll also be speaking to delegates, and I imagine there'll be a few other speakers who will be called to the microphone as well. If you'd like to hear those addresses live, we'll have them available to you on our website, npr.org, npr.org. We'll have a complete report on convention activities coming up at about 5:20 this afternoon on All Things Considered, so make sure you join us for that. And then make sure you tune in tomorrow, starting at 9 o'clock in the morning. We'll be on the air with more live coverage here from the Republican Party State Convention. We'll also hear the president speak. Should be a busy day tomorrow, and I sure hope you'll be able to tune in. Gary Eichten, reporting live from the Mayo Civic Center.
The stories are incredible. The reporting, unbelievable. The host, highly suspect. Dale Connolly reporting Friday night at 11 and Saturday afternoon at 2 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
We have a fair sky. It's up to 83 degrees at KNOW FM 91.1 Minneapolis and St. Paul. Temperature will continue to rise through the afternoon, hitting the mid-90s perhaps. Tonight, 30% chance for showers in the cities with a low near 70, rather. 40% chance for thunderstorms in the Twin Cities tomorrow.
From National Public Radio in New York, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The publicly funded Human Genome Project and the private company